Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, listeners. I'd like to invite you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, download our ebook on organic gardening basics, and get started on building your very own organic oasis today. Welcome to the show today. I am very, very, very excited to introduce my guest because she has written one of the best books I have read this whole year. It's about some amazing Montana farmers. She's a great storyteller, so even if you're not interested in farming, you will love this story, this book. And I think you'll also be inspired not just by the tale of these visionary and dedicated farmers who stuck with organics against some amazing odds, but you'll also learn how simply adding a new food to your diet can help change the world. So I'm super excited to introduce Liz Carlisle, who wrote The Lentil Underground. Welcome to the show today, Liz.
Thanks, Jackie. My pleasure.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and tell us just a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So my name is Liz, and I'm originally from Montana and didn't grow up in a farming family, but my dad had this great garden. And my grandma was a farmer, and she had lost her family farm in the Dust Bowl. So, you know, grew up in Montana hearing these stories about why it was so important that we make our agriculture more sustainable. So that was kind of how I got interested in organic farming, if you will. I didn't even really know it was called organics then. But fast forward a few years, and my first career was as a country singer. So I was traveling around the country and meeting farmers from all over the place and realized that people were having some of the same problems, actually, that my grandmother's family had had during the Dust Bowl with the industrialization of agriculture, essentially, and, you know, using too many chemicals and soil health was declining and farmers were seeing those problems and having other kinds of problems with the industry associated with conventional agriculture as well. And so I wanted to try to be part of the solution and heard about John Tester. Of course, when he ran for Senate, that made a lot of news. And this organic farmer made his way into, you know, the halls of government. So I ended up going to work for him, quit my job as a country singer. And through that work, met all these really innovative organic farmers from Montana. Because my job was to be a liaison to the state and sort of get ideas for our policy team. And I realized that we just have such an innovative group of organic farmers and gardeners in Montana who took it upon themselves to find more sustainable systems. And that was the inspiration for me to go back to grad school and do this book project to write about the origins of the organic movement in Montana.
Wow. Well, I could talk to you all day about things like that. So if case listeners don't know and they didn't quite catch it. So John Tester is our senator from Montana. And he did, he grew up in Big Sandy, right? And he has a huge organic farm there. And he is still our senator in the Senate today. So I'm so curious, like how you go from country singer to liaison out of Washington, D.C. then?
Yeah. Well, you know, I pretty much just told him the story that I told you. So I quit my job as a country singer and I wanted to go to work in sustainable agriculture. And I came home to Montana and then this position was advertised. It was called Legislative Correspondent for Agriculture and Natural Resources in the office of Senator John Tester. And I didn't realize it was based in DC at first. I thought it was a position in the state and I got really excited and I went in for an informational interview and I was sold on the job before I realized I'd be moving back to the East Coast. But, you know, I think they heard the honesty in my motivations for doing it. And I had a college education and knew about writing, knew about storytelling, and it just worked out. It was a great education for me. In addition to the senator himself, he had a lot of incredible Montanans with a long history of doing natural resources collaborative work. So it was kind of like a master's degree, honestly, to go work in that office.
Awesome. Okay. So then what did you end up getting your master's degree in?
Well, so I went straight from that to a PhD program.
Oh, you did. Okay.
Yeah, in geography at UC Berkeley. And what I really liked about geography is that I could study natural science and social science. So I could get both of those aspects of how do we make a transition to a more sustainable food system and focus on the policy angle as well as learning some of the ecology behind why do we rotate certain crops, what do we need to do to take care of our water, our soil, all these fundamental resources at the heart of our food system.
Wow. Okay. Who would have thought that that would come under a geography degree?
Right. Yeah. We do more than maps.
Okay. So then where do you want to start? Do you want to tell us your book starts out like you came in the spring and went to Timeless Seeds with Dave Oren. Is that how it starts?
Yeah. Yeah. So I had met a few of these organic farmers through my work in the tester office. And they started telling me, you know, the whole key to doing organics in Montana is that we have these monocultures of wheat that farms exist in now. And in order to convert them to a system that doesn't rely on chemicals, you know, these wheat monocrops rely on chemical fertility. We have to put the nitrogen back in the soil that the wheat keeps using up. So in order to go organic, we would need a crop that would make its own nitrogen. And so this is, of course, what crops in the legume family do. And all of your listeners know about this, organic gardeners, you know, organic gardening 101, right? Mm-hmm. You got to fix nitrogen. And so anything in this bean family will do that. And these farmers needed a crop that they could also market. And they needed one, of course, that worked in Montana's climate. So they hit on lentils. So I kept hearing from people, you know, lentils are so important to being able to do organic farming in Montana. And the person who taught me about lentils was, and it was always either David Oyen or somebody else who'd learned from David Oyen, right? I mean, this guy who was trying it in the 80s and who had built this business with other farming friends. And so what I gathered from that is that I really needed to meet David Oyen. So as soon as I had done the coursework part of my degree, that's what I did, is I drove out to Conrad, where his family farm is, where he grew up, and just interviewed him.
Okay. And do you want to tell us about that, like how the interviews went, or where'd you go from there? Or
sure. Yeah. So, you know, super genial guy, and had a lot of information to share about his background in farming, what it had been like to start a business, to try to make it economically viable to grow these ecologically appropriate crops. Because you go from hauling your wheat to the elevator to just having these lentils and nowhere necessarily to sell them. Mm-hmm. So he and his friends had to develop their own processing and their own markets with the idea that if they did that, then it could be possible for other farmers to add rotation crops and make it possible for them to transition to organic. So this all was fascinating, and I decided, yes, absolutely, this needs to be the focus of my dissertation project. And he was kind enough to put me in touch with the network of people who grow for Timeless Seeds, this business that was started to process and market ecologically appropriate rotation crops, mostly lentils, also chickpeas and some ancient grains. And based in Ulm, Montana is where their facility is, just outside of Great Falls. And so then that next summer, which was 2012, I just spent the growing season going around and interviewing all of these people who grow for Timeless Seeds. So about 15 current growers and some past growers and some researchers who collaborate. Overall, I think I probably interviewed 45 people or something like that. And getting to kind of shadow them in what they did and get a sense for it. When the organic inspector came, I would tag along. I'd ride along in the combine. You know, just to kind of get a sense of what made this kind of farming different from typical conventional wheat farming, and honestly, how they all did it. You know, how do you start a new farming system from scratch that didn't even have markets, didn't have research behind it to help you think about, well, when should I start planting this? What should the seeding rate be? Some of those basic questions. You know, and basically came to find that in addition to developing these cooperative systems among plants, if you will, synergies in the rotation crops, that they had developed cooperative systems among people. and they'd figured out ways to share labor and to share knowledge, certainly to pool their resources to come up with processing infrastructure so that they could actually, you know, on a certain scale, really develop a new food system in central Montana.
And central Montana is really dry, so that was a lot of kind of part of what inspired them also, right, was to be able to grow a crop in a place where there's a lot of drought.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, rotations are a little bit easier puzzle if you get a lot of rainfall. Like, of course, the Midwest has been rotating legumes for ages. They've been rotating soybeans into corn. They have longer growing seasons and they have more rain. And that was really the challenge for the Northern Great Plains and for central Montana, is if you've got 14 to 18 inches of rainfall a year, you know you need a certain amount for your wheat crop. Does it make sense to rotate anything, or are you going to be using up moisture that you need? Well, you know, they just tried it, and they looked at other dry land regions around the world, and they said, we think we can do these legumes. We think we can do these chickpeas, these dry peas, and that it'll be good, you know, if we use our cover crops to keep the soil in cover rather than having a fallow year. And it's really a great example, I think, as we look at what the impacts of climate change are going to be in different regions around the world and how we can be more resilient in our agriculture. Central Montana has a lot to offer as a region that's definitely weathered a lot of drought and really volatile weather conditions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when we were at the Aero Convention, you talked a lot about the challenges, like if we know that doing the rotations and growing things like lentils or legumes can help farmers be more productive or, you know, have a better season, like what are some of the challenges? Why aren't more people doing it, right?
Right, yeah. And there's just so many different categories of challenges like that. And some of them, of course, you know, gardeners will recognize this, are just plain agronomic. Things like, I'm worried that I'm not going to be able to terminate a cover crop in time, or, you know, I'm concerned this is not going to fit into the other things that I normally plant. And some of that has to do with not as much research on some of these rotation systems as we have on, you know, hybrid wheat that is managed with chemicals. We have so much research on that, so we've really dialed in that system with all this experience and all this research, and we don't have that advantage yet with some of these organic rotation systems. And then a lot of times there's kind of a social aspect to it as well, that if you live in a rural community that's relatively tight-knit, everybody kind of knows everybody, and social life is based around a particular farming system. Everybody's kind of in the field at the same time. They're used to seeing weed-free fields, only one plant. It's going against the grain, so to speak, to do something different. And that can have a lot of social consequences. You know, maybe you lose a friendship when you no longer go to the fertilizer dealer, when you're not contracting with somebody to spray. You know, maybe one of your neighbors starts to make comments if they see your lentils look a little weedy.
That was a big thing you talked about in the book a lot, was like people, like neighbors, you know, questioning what they were doing and the weed problem.
Right. Yeah. And I think that probably is resonant for most people who live in a farm community, is that it's so visual, you know, it's such a public occupation. People drive right by and they look at your field and they adjudicate it from the framework that they have of what successful farming looks like. Mm-hmm. And diversified farming just plain looks different. And of course, to a lot of us, it looks beautiful. A diverse organic garden is gorgeous. But if it's outside of your experience and what you're used to seeing is a really, you know, sort of precise wheat field with nothing else in it, you might even see a crop plant and think it's a weed just because it's a different family of plant. It looks really different. So plenty of people would see a lentil plant and not even recognize that that was intentional, you know?
Mm-hmm. And then that was some of the problems they had with the lentils, is that they were little and like how to harvest them and then how to sort them, because lentils kind of have some challenges, right, with you know, you get rocks in there, or if you get, like, I remember reading Oh, I wish, like, I read the book over Thanksgiving break and then I had to give it back to the library. I wish I would have held it for one more week, but you know, I knew there's somebody else waiting for the book too, but it was like, wasn't it something about like they got their first contract through Trader Joe's and then did somebody get a rock and a lentil or something? Or
yeah,
am I remembering that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Timeless got their first contract with Trader Joe's. That was their first big buyer. And Trader Joe's contracted for so much volume that they couldn't find it all in Montana. And so they had to buy in some additional
From Canada, yeah. Right?
Right, exactly. And so there was a rock in one of those because of the cleaning process. And that's not unusual for grain, certainly. But what's challenging for people with lentils exactly is they're lower to the ground. So you can use a conventional combine. People have better luck with some of the older equipment quite often and drive it a little bit more slowly. And there are some special combine headers, too, that are specifically for lentils. They're called flex headers. But another thing that's funny about lentils compared to wheat is that from a climate perspective, this is really helpful. They have an indeterminate growth habit, which means they don't necessarily all mature at the same time, at the same time of year, or at the same time as each other. It's really based on how much rainfall they get. So they'll grow when it rains, and they'll sort of pause themselves, go semi-dormant. So it's helpful from a climate resilient standpoint because they can weather periods of drought and sort of wait for the rain. You know, they're sort of adaptable in that way. It makes it harder to plan for them, however, because they'll sort of mature not quite all at the same time and not at a predictable time. So you tend to have about a week window as a lentil farmer when you can harvest them. And if you're too early, they'll still be too green. And if you're too late, they'll ripen and fall on the ground and you'll lose them. Yes. And you're kind of judging the median of your crop when you do this because it's not fully uniform. So all of that it definitely takes extra knowledge. And, you know, it's a bigger, I think, intellectual challenge for the farmer, which was what excited a lot of these farmers, honestly. You know, some of them were feeling like they'd kind of hit the limit of their curiosity with, you know, sort of the industrial system. And they were able to use their brains more by incorporating more diverse crops and having to work with these ecological cycles.
I was just thinking of something I was going to ask. So some of the other challenges, like I remember, was like, you know, people, like they started small, right? Like people whose families have been doing farming one way for years, didn't they start with like a very small thing and then kind of learned as they grew or as they went?
Yeah, that was a pretty common story, is that it would be, you know, somebody wanted to convert to organics and they were, you know, maybe 30s and coming back to a family place and their parents were still managing it. And they would ask, you know, can I have a couple fields to experiment with organics and with crop rotations? And, you know, sort of with the idea, well, if this pans out, maybe they'll let me do this on a few more fields. and so that's the way it's happened on some of these multi-generational farms. It's happening on farms in Montana right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, do you want to tell us about some of the characters that you met? Because you got some pretty cool characters in the book.
Yes. Yeah. And character is actually an apt term, not just in the context of a book, but really, you know, certainly if you've ever been around Montana's organic farming community or a lot of organic farming communities, it's just full of characters and really diverse characters.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that interested me in researching this story, and why I wanted to tell it is because I think there's this perception that culturally and politically, organic farmers are sort of all of a piece, right? That we're all hippie liberals and that we probably all vote for the same people and all have similar beliefs, you know, politically speaking. And what I found with the Montana organic community is that people came to organics from really different value systems, from in some cases deep, religious beliefs. There are a couple families in the book who homeschool their children and are devoutly Christian. Some people came out of the counterculture in the 60s and were inspired by Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and participated in marches against Vietnam. You know, and some people are politically very libertarian, and their concern about the industrial food system was that they just felt like they wanted more independence from the level of corporate and government power that was represented in that system. And so from all these different standpoints, people kind of came together around, well, if we could build, you know, sort of a local, ecologically appropriate food system where we had control over our own destiny and we weren't using so many chemicals, that would feel like the right thing. You know, it would be the right thing for our economic bottom line. It's the right thing for the health of our customers and our families. And it seems like the responsible thing to do for our land. So it is kind of this bunch of characters. And it was interesting. I was telling you, I was at the Montana Organic Association conference, first weekend of December. And a couple of these folks who come from fairly different backgrounds got into this really deep question about spirituality and the creation and how we, you know, whether we should pursue our spirituality in institutions or outside of institutional religion. And it just reminded me that the level of dialogue going on among these people as they cooperate in, you know, making organic farming viable goes to the heart of the human experience. And in this day and age of really divided politics, it's a pretty refreshing thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I really think Montanans are kind of a special kind of person. You know, and I have friends from all different political spectrums, but, you know, I'm a pretty radical liberal. And if Montanans have accepted me and we can manage to get along, I figure just about everybody can. So, well, do you want to tell us, like, about maybe some of the farms that you went to visit? Like, I was excited to read about, is their name Crabtree, that are up on the northern border?
Yeah, that's a great story. Doug Crabtree and Anna Jones Crabtree, they literally farm about as close to Canada as you can get without being in Canada. They are 45 minutes north of Havre, Montana. So, you know, thriving metropolis.
Right? But Havre is, right? It does have a college.
Right, yeah, but they are out there in North Havre. Yeah. North Havre. And it's interesting. Doug grew up on a farm, and his family lost their farm in the farm crisis of the 80s. And Anna did not grow up on a farm. And they met one another, and they were professionals. Both had graduate degrees. Doug actually ran Montana's first organic certification program. He was an inspector, and he helped build that program and went around training inspectors and inspecting farmers. And Anna has a PhD in engineering, and she was doing sort of systems-level sustainability work. And they both felt like they really wanted to have their hands in the dirt, essentially. They wanted, you know, to be on the front lines of making a more sustainable world. And so they bought this property up way north of Havre, real challenging ground to farm, you know, obviously has a lot of challenges in life in general. It's not a quick trip to the grocery store up there. Mm-hmm. And they just wanted it to be a model of diversified semi-arid farming. So they've got a couple thousand acres up there, and it's all farmed in these 36-foot strips. And they rotate through a repertoire of over 20 crops. Oh. And yeah. So it looks like they sent me these diagrams. I have a couple of them online. It looks like a garden plan if you look at these diagrams, you know, with the diversity of it and all these strips. But it's just on a 2,000-acre scale. And they have, you know, pollinator-friendly borders in between the crops. They're really intentional about how they rotate, rotating through different families of crops, rotating through crops that mature at different times of year, and just a really beautiful model of a mid-scale diversified farm. And they want people to understand that not all organic farms have to be, you know, 10 acres, that in this part of the country, where we do have semi-arid conditions and we need people to steward larger amounts of acres if we're going to get a handle on some of these landscape scale ecological problems, you really can farm with this diversity at that scale.
Okay. What about the tuna guy?
He's great. Tuna McAlpine. He is a rancher in Valier, Montana, which is right on the Rocky Mountain front where the Rocky Mountains meet the prairie, close to Glacier Park. Mm-hmm. And he was actually raised as a farmer, mostly doing row crops, but he decided that for his land, it was appropriate to put the land into perennials, essentially to restore it, and only farm a fairly limited acreage and then do grass-fed livestock on the rest of it. And he's one of these guys who's super libertarian, you know, actually thought the Republican Party was getting a little too soft on guns. he's just a crack up, but deeply respected in the organic community and by a lot of people who are quite left politically. He's a great ecological restorationist and just decided that was his responsibility on his land. For many years, he direct marketed a lot of his livestock, which was kind of an opportunity for him to educate with consumers, and it was fun. He'd do these pig roasts, and he'd show up at, natural food stores and that kind of thing. But he knows an awful lot about how to transform a piece of land slowly and heal it, and also a neat example of a rancher who really embraces coexistence with wildlife. And I had this great experience at his place where we both saw a grizzly bear running across a hill, and I had just met him, and I was worried that, you know, his thinking on that matter might be shoot, shovel, and shut up, you know? And I'm a grad student at Berkeley. I'm from Missoula. If you're not a Montanan, that's where the hippies in Montana tend to be.
It's kind of when I first came up here, my husband's like, you got to be careful driving around with those 4-county plates.
Right, yeah. You know, and so I didn't want to say anything when I saw the bear because I didn't want to come off as, I don't know, arrogant. But he was the first to say, he was so excited about it, and he wanted me to take out my camera and take a picture and show his wife and kids. And he understood that as kind of a vote of confidence from the natural world for his management, that he was doing such a good job taking care of his land that bear thought it was a good place to hang out. And that meant it was going to be good for his cows too.
I like that. I know what I was going to ask you earlier was, and it was the tuna thing, because didn't he, like, isn't there a part of it that they kind of work together, all these farmers, to help each other, like loaning each other tractors and different pieces of equipment to help each other get started? And I remember something about the people who were homeschooling down, I don't know if they were close to Villiers or somewhere also, but their first crop wasn't going well. Their first crop of lentils didn't succeed. And so then they were worried the second year, if it didn't go good, they were going to go back the other way. And then it did make it, but.
Yeah. And there's been informally for many, many years, people have been, and in the conventional farm community too, but certainly among organic farmers, that kind of sharing knowledge, sharing equipment. But there was a particular program called the Farm Improvement Club program that ran through the whole decade of the 90s. And it was ARRO, the Alternative Energy Resource Organization, that sponsored it. And this woman, Nancy Matheson, brilliant, brilliant woman who grew up on a farm in Conrad, who directed it. And that was a program that gave really small grants to groups of farmers who would get together, had to be 4 farmers and a technical assistance provider to solve some kind of problem related to sustainability. So it could just be they were trialing out some new rotation crops, they were trying new methods of organic weed management, but they were using each other's farms like, as an experiment, as a comparison to see how different things worked. And so tuna was part of one of those clubs. He was part of one of those clubs actually with David Oyen from Timeless Seeds. And a lot of people got to know each other through those clubs. And it really sped up, I think, the adoption of these organic methods, these sustainable methods, for lots of reasons. And some of it was just that they were able to share knowledge and able to figure out some of these technical challenges. But people also developed these networks of support and mutual aid, and they had somebody to call if they had a question. They had somebody to call if their tractor was broke down and they really needed to do something tomorrow, you know, who could loan them a piece of equipment. And those relationships have lasted for decades.
Excellent. Okay. Do you want to tell people why they should eat lentils?
Of course. I love to tell people about lentils. So, you know, we talked a little bit about kind of the farmer's perspective and the ecological perspective. So lentils are this great crop for farmers because farmers don't have to use chemical nitrogen fertilizer if they're rotating legumes like lentils. And that's important if you care about climate change, because that synthetic fertilizer takes so much natural gas to manufacture. It's actually a really big part of the carbon footprint of our diet. So you think, you know, when you're eating lentils or chickpeas, that you're helping a farmer take some of that carbon footprint out of our whole food system. Well, at the same time, you're doing your body a favor, because that nitrogen, when it hits your body, that's protein. So they're an excellent, excellent source of plant-based protein. Probably know they're a great source of fiber. Those two things tend to be pretty well known. But they're also a great source of a number of micronutrients. They're the highest natural source of folate, which is really important for pregnant women. And they're also extremely high in antioxidants, 56% higher in antioxidant capacity than blueberries.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. And then also they have a low glycemic index, which is really important for diabetics. So, you know, there's a reason why this crop has been rotated with grain for 10,000 years since the beginning of agriculture. It's great for the health of the soil, and it's also great for the health of our bodies. It's been this staple for working people around the world, you know, since the beginning of agriculture. And as a result, there are all these great recipes from around the world. Lentils you find in the cuisine of essentially every continent. So you can experiment with Indian dal, you can experiment with African stews. There are all these great ways, sort of beyond lentil soup, to incorporate lentils into your home cooking.
Mm-hmm. And then chickpeas also, like probably a lot of people eat hummus, but maybe don't know that chickpeas is what hummus is made of, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, and those also, Timeless Seeds grows and markets those, both the yellow variety that most people have seen and also this totally beautiful black variety, black kabuli chickpeas. So if you see those, definitely grab some of those. They make the most beautiful, stunning black hummus. And as with a lot of foods of that color, they're really high in anthocyanins and antioxidants.
Okay. And then what about, there's that baby beluga lentil that they have too, right? That's kind of a specialty food.
Yeah. Yeah. So they pretty much have, Timeless really wanted to grow a bunch of different heirloom lentils. So you can find almost every color of the rainbow in their line, red, yellow, green, brown, and then these little black ones called black belugas. And they have such an interesting story. They were originally from what was formerly known as Czechoslovakia. Oh. Yeah, yeah. And they were picked up by a Russian plant collector in the early 20th century. And then from the Russians' plant collection, they were transferred to our collection in the United States. And along with other crops in that family, they found themselves in Pullman, Washington. And the seed was just sitting in this vault until a breeder from Saskatchewan, Al Slinkard, who would later come to be known as Dr. Lentil, total character, he picked them up and started growing them out and started promoting them as a cover crop because they generated so much biomass. So he had released them only as a cover crop and not for use in the food market, not for use even in the feed market. And David Oyen and some of these other early lentil growers had been growing them out in test plots. And, you know, David just was eating them himself, feeding them to his own livestock. Because, whatever, right? he didn't care about what category it was supposed to be in. And the Saskatchewan breeder just thought, you know, who would ever want to cook a black hard-seeded lentil? It just didn't fit into his conception of what people were interested in. But then, you know, the food world kind of moves along and specialty foods start to be more interesting to gourmet chefs. And one day, David Oyen gets this call from a specialty buyer who wants something new that looks different so that chefs will have this food of distinction. And he starts thinking about this little lentil in his test plot. And he said, well, you know, it's not been released officially into the food market, but it didn't kill me. It didn't kill my cows. It didn't kill my sheep. So I'll send you a package if you want. And she said, well, you know, it looks like beluga caviar. We should call him Black Beluga. So that was the beginning. And that has become the signature crop for Timeless Seeds is these Black Beluga lentils.
And they're good.
Yes. Yeah, they're delicious. So pick up a bag and try them yourself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, anything else do you want to share with us today? Did I miss anything?
We covered a lot of bases, Jackie.
I know.
No, I
have like 5 pages of notes.
All right. Well, you can tell me what we talked about afterward. Okay. I can review. No, that was wonderful. I just really thank you for having me on the podcast and just want to thank organic gardeners everywhere who are listening to this, the stewardship work that you do and the education that you do just by putting one of these systems in your own yard. Such a huge contribution and I just appreciate it. And thanks for listening.
Aw, well, thank you for sharing with us today. Tell everybody where they can get a copy of the book, because I know they're going to want to get one for their family, for people for Christmas presents, and just, it's a great read. Like, I just can't tell you, you know, you really enjoy it just as the story, not just because it's an important story to read, but you're just a really good storyteller. I think it's the country singer in you.
Thanks, Jackie. I appreciate that. Well, the website is lentilunderground.com, and we have links there to all the usual suspects online. Powell's, which is an indie bookstore, has an online version, which I recommend. But, you know, a bunch of independent bookstores all over the country have it in stock, and your independent bookseller loves it also if you go in and order a copy from them. So that would be my recommendation.
Okay. And I'll put the links to Timeless Seeds in there, too, if they want to order some lentils.
Yes. Excellent idea.
Organic lentils.
That's right. That's right. Organic lentils from Central Montana family farmers.
And save a few to plant in your garden this year.
Right. Yes. Any but the red or the yellow varieties because the skins have been taken off. So those will not be viable in your garden. But every other variety, you can just plant what's in the bag.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Thanks, Jackie. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening and remember to grow.